So I promise you Dilemma is not returning as a Israel-Palestine-only essay forum or something, but I just wrote another essay, and I'm just going to read it here. I got a wonderful response by the last one that I put out, and a lot of people who reached out and told me they were happy to have my voice in the conversation. And so I just had a lot more to get off my chest, and it's kind of a personal essay about my experience. And I hope you enjoy it. I also am putting it out because I've been watching what's been happening, like everyone else, of course, and keeping an eye on the language in particular, which is being used, and in particular at a UN assembly that just occurred, that I'm going to come back at the end after the essay and just comment a little bit on again, because I don't think I've ever written something that was just so drastically and identically mirrored on the screen of the news events that as this. And so it was just so timely, and I felt like I had to say something. I know I'm speaking about my experience, but I'm sure other people have similar experiences. I'm sure there's a lot of you out there, and this is for us. So here you go, another essay on Israel and Palestine, and then I'll stop doing these, and the next time you see Dilemma pop up on your phone or on your screen or wherever it is, it will be a really cool episode with a speaker and guest, and probably won't be about this. So here you go, an essay I'm calling Anti-Semitism and the Future of Analysis. In 2018, I directed a film entitled Islam and the Future of Tolerance. The film, based on the published dialogues between Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz, champions the importance of conversation and productive disagreement in the face of an emotionally charged, massively important, and consequential topic. The film doesn't have a traditional protagonist versus antagonist structure, but if it has a nemesis, it would be something like the confusion and intellectual paralysis which results in an inability to honestly critique a set of ideas. The hero, then, is the freedom and courage to conduct open, honest analysis and, as the title suggests, the principle of intellectual, ethnic, and ideological tolerance, which is crucial to uphold in a liberal post-Enlightenment tradition. The nemesis of this honest pursuit of analysis was encapsulated in the charge of Islamophobia, which was, and still is, often used to shut down any inquiry into the complex motivations of specific forms of violence. To emphasize the primary point, the idea was not that ideology was the only factor to discuss, but that it must be considered in conjunction with other forces like history, economics, class dynamics, individual psychology, resource distribution, and political sociology. The point was never to ignore something like the geopolitics of oil consumption, for example, but that in the complete analysis, religious ideology should and must, of course, also be considered. All of this must also be done while not erasing the real phenomena of racism and discrimination towards Muslims, but rather to help combat it. I was and still am convinced that the real tragedy of that particular conversational roadblock was that it was preventing a necessary shift towards moral reforms within Islam, which would advance human rights. And much more importantly, it was promoting a significant upgrade to the language used within the West to help distinguish ideas and the people who prescribe to them. The conversation introduced categories like Islamism, as distinct from jihadism, as distinct from conservative Islam, as distinct from reforming or liberal Muslims. When I was making the film, I was thinking mostly about preventing discrimination and hatred against Muslims in the West, much more so than I was deluding myself to think that the holy books would be reformed in Indonesian madrasas. In light of the current war being waged in Gaza and the pathetic state of public conversation on that topic, I want to share my life experience regarding another extremely dangerous and urgent phenomenon which takes a disturbingly similar form. Part 1. Chosen. I was born in 1982 in a conservative Jewish household in an American suburb. Judaism has always been a strange sort of thing, which dances conveniently between calling itself an ethnicity and a religious ideology. I'm an atheist, as are both of my parents. As a family, we attended high holidays and very occasional Shabbat services. I was bar mitzvahed and attended Hebrew school until I was a teenager. I was never given a very strict vision of metaphysics or the supernatural from my Judaism. For example, I was never told what would happen to my soul or other souls after death. I learned the biblical stories. I learned about Noah's animals and the flood, Moses leading the enslaved Jews out of Egypt with the help of a homicidal plague-sending God, and, of course, Abraham nearly sacrificing his son on a mountain before God's angel tapped him on the shoulder at the last minute and whispered, "Just kidding." I learned about all these things through cartoons, children's books, songs, movies, and as I got older, discussions with the local religious leaders of my synagogue and translations of the Torah. But none of those things really mattered to the kind of Judaism I was being indoctrinated into. In fact, my sarcastic tone in the retelling of those stories carried only mild discipline or condemnation, and sometimes even comical agreement from rabbis themselves. What really mattered to the Jewish story that I was learning was one thing and one thing only, Israel. Israel, I was told, was promised to the chosen people by God. But again, that religious bent wasn't really the thing to take seriously. What I needed to take seriously was the story that Jews were not safe in the world, and that Israel was a modern political miracle and the only safe haven for Jews. It was under constant threat and always just hanging by a thread, right from the start. I, as a born Jew, could play a crucial role in ensuring that it survived. That was my birthright, and my burden, and my doctrine. This under-threat story was supported by a holy book which told of endless persecutions of Jews by their enemies for thousands of years. Every American Jew knows the joke that Jewish holiday gatherings all go like this. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. But again, I need not take the word of a holy book with incredibly suspect fact-checking as the proof of this story. I only had to talk to my oldest relatives to learn about the horrors of the Holocaust to verify the overall ethos. I was brought to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. by my Hebrew school on a sort of pilgrimage of this mythology. The museum is incredible and should absolutely be visited by everyone. The darkest depths of human depravity are on full emotional display. In the context of the Jewish experience which I was being exposed to, it was easy to feel the perpetual shadow of extermination which casts itself over my lineage. And if I'm not diligent, it will come for me too. This visit happened a few years before nearly all of my friends went on summer trips to Israel, which included spending intimate time with the Israel Defense Force between an itinerary of fun and festivities. That trip, it was easy to see, was the real bar mitzvah, which would complete one's rite of passage into the Jewish community, rather than the religiously outlined bar mitzvah, which was supposed to grant one the right to read from the Torah. My Jewish education can be summarized in such a way where the holiest tenet of post-Holocaust Judaism is distilled to a two-word prayer, never again. The prayer is intentionally vague as it leaves open interpretation to either extend to read never again to anyone anywhere or never again to us. This interpretation fault line has become a full political fracture in the Jewish conversation and mirrors the more familiar nationalist versus globalist tension in the post-Cold War discourse. In either interpretation of never againism, the state of Israel takes center stage as an enclave and fortress. I was given a steady diet of reminders that anti-Semitism is not just a thing in museums and not only contained to anomalous fascist flare-ups in distant parts of the world. No. Anti-Semitism is everywhere and somehow always rising. Given that truth, it's important for Jews to have a place to flee in the event that things go sideways in Europe, America, or elsewhere. The evidence of the Holocaust was rather convincing that there is something to that logic, and it could happen very quickly. It didn't matter that Seinfeld was the number one show in America during my youth. The anti-Semitism tide rises suddenly, and we could be washed away in a flash. For many Jews I grew up with, this form of identity is profoundly meaningful and constitutes the entire gravitational force for their engagement with doctrinally outlined behaviors like wearing a yarmulke, fasting on Yom Kippur, or keeping kosher. It isn't about getting into heaven or obeying religious dictates for reasons of divine commandment. It's about paying homage to the lineage and performing a silent promise that you are doing your part to pass the flame along to the future in an improbable act of solemn and noble defiance. This kind of participatory secular community holds a deep appeal, even to a skeptical teenager like I was. But there was this nagging issue clinging to this never again ship of identity, which discouraged me from boarding fully. There were all these people who were claiming that they were being brutally mistreated and oppressed at the hands of this special place that I was told was crucially important to support. They were called Palestinians. Part 2, Sticks and Stones. To a peace-loving liberal teenager watching violent clashes on a grainy television, it seemed like the Palestinians had some legitimate gripes, or at least it seemed like throwing rocks should not be met with live deadly bullets. That looked pretty unfair, and it ran counter to the playground ethics which we were all learning from the same parents who were sending us to Hebrew school. I was given a lot of explanations for this response which absolved Israel of moral wrongdoing. I was told to put myself in the shoes of the Israelis and understand their difficult situation and how they didn't really want to hurt anyone, but they really had no choice. As I grew a bit older, I was informed about political histories which placed the blame for the deaths at the feet of the Arab nations. Those Palestinians fled their homelands willingly a long time ago, or were instructed to leave by their own governments. Those governments had lost the land in a war. It was all fair and square, and the Palestinians were just being sore losers. The Israelis were just playing by the rules, and, of course, I mustn't forget that the anti-Semitic monster wears a lot of masks throughout history. This really was just another iteration of the same old phenomenon. To many of us, it was difficult to shake the feeling that this was all a bit hypocritical. It was difficult to decipher the truth from the web of revisionism and self-righteousness regarding the psychological makeup of Jews that we were all getting. But what was undeniable through it all was never-againism, which had a way of silencing any doubts about Israel's so-called defensive aggression. Even if the story about the Palestinians we were getting wasn't exactly correct, it didn't really matter in the face of an existential threat. To the liberal American Jew, everything could be justified by efforts to prevent the next Jewish Holocaust, which was always just looming right around the corner. This includes forming alliances with ideologies and ideas which would otherwise be abhorred. The only thing that mattered in the consequentialist mathematics was if the alliance would bolster the unwavering defense of Israel from its bloodthirsty anti-Semitic neighbors. I witnessed my Jewish community shrug when Israel would happily embrace extreme religious right-wing Christians who championed the State of Israel for their own rapturous reasons. I grumbled but was hushed as my community watched the relentless expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, even while I knew many of them to be privately opposed to them. It didn't matter that the settlers were loudly preaching a religious mandate that was clearly outlined in the Torah and granted them divine claim to the land. My community knew not to take those wacky religious ideas of the settlers too seriously, but it told itself that those settlements were a necessary buffer zone for security and Israel's survival. I gritted my teeth as I sensed the dehumanized attitude towards Gazans, who I was urged not to extend compassion towards in the same way as I was towards Jews. At best, they were unfortunate pawns of a geopolitical game, and at worst, they were simply endorsing a new form of Nazism, which must be caged, stifled, and surveilled in the name of Israel's survival. It was explained to me that Palestine didn't even really exist, and never did. The people were a result of a myth created by Arab nations who simply had it out for Israel and Jews. They were just poor, brainwashed people who now had to be kept in perpetual quarantine until a Palestinian leadership which was serious about peace could emerge. All of these things were perfectly explained by the never again mantra and the ever-present threat of anti-Semitism, a phenomena I was told was global and aggressive, but which I had never experienced personally. Israel must behave in these ways in the face of these facts, and she has to take any friend she can find, even the ones that we normally wouldn't be caught dead with at a political convention. Here's the contradiction that I was piecing together. I didn't know what it meant to be a Jew, and I began to worry that whatever Judaism was, it was in grave danger of distorting itself into a disfigured extremism which would bring about the biggest threat to its survival of all. Part 3. The Jewish Mother's Son. I really liked Hanukkah as a kid. 8 days of presents and fun spinning toys, what's not to like? I wasn't the first to note that this felt like a very American phenomena, where assimilating Jewish families inflated a minor holiday which happened to fall on the calendar near Christmas. This would help distinguish American Jews from their neighbors while also participating in an American tradition, and, of course, quell the jealousy of Jewish children when they saw their classmates' cool new sneakers. But this holiday also has the perfectly apt dual nature of the post-Holocaust American Jewry. It intertwines yet another story of Jewish survival in the land of what is now the West Bank against an enemy dedicated to its destruction, with a touch of divine intervention where God helps tip the scales in favor of his chosen people. The Maccabees' revolt against the evil Greek emperor succeeded against all odds and was punctuated by God performing a miracle in extending the burn time of the oil used to light the eternal flame when they reclaimed their temple. I could choose to dismiss the divine part of that story as a fairy tale, but I would have to take seriously the other parts in the ways in which it helped bolster never-againism. Beyond all the external threats, which I must pay close attention to, there were some other things I should know about Judaism's survival. I was not so subtly urged to disapprove of intermarriage, or if one had happened between some distant friend or relative, I was to take some solace in knowing that the children of such an alliance would be raised Jewish, whatever that meant. By the time I was 13, I knew that I didn't believe a word of the religious ideology. I would read along with the English translation of the prayer books as the congregation chanted and nodded in Hebrew, a language which nearly all of us knew how to pronounce, but almost none of us knew how to translate. I thought that Judaism's scriptural moral tenets were quite bad and unexamined, and I didn't even like the food very much. All of this, I was told, wasn't a problem for my Jewishness. In fact, it kind of incorporated me into the classic self-deprecating Jewish humor tract in some rabbinical concept about wrestling with God, as if doubt and skepticism was a distinctly Jewish invention. But when I began to outwardly question the moral conduct of the state of Israel, that was a big problem. To do that was to question the unquestionable. My experience is echoed in the results of a Pew Research poll of American Jews held in 2020. They found that 8 in 10 U.S. Jews say that caring about Israel is an essential or important part of what being Jewish means to them. What's so interesting about the result is how generational this response was. When the most extreme form of the question was posed as caring about Israel is essential to being Jewish, 52% of Jews 65 and older responded in the affirmative, and only 35% of the respondents aged 18 to 29 did. This generational slip is to be expected as the memory of the Holocaust and Israel's founding begins to shift from direct experience to grandparents' vague stories to hazy family lineage and exhibits at museums. The generational slide is also no secret to Israel, which must be sensing that its default unconditional American support may be fading. In a rush to secure itself from the slackening support, it began to take more and more extreme positions in the 1990s, and now has handed over the keys to its policy towards Palestinians to its own religious extremists, the ones who take the divine parts of the stories of Hanukkah very seriously. One of the most telling pieces of data in the Pew Research poll was the stark difference between Jews who believe God literally gave them the land of Israel. 87% of Orthodox Jews agree with that statement, while only 46% and 26% of conservative and reform Jews do, respectively. That same Orthodox group gave Donald Trump an 86% approval rating regarding his policy towards Israel, someone who is not exactly well-read on the religious doctrines of the Torah. This was all worrisome to me, because you have to understand something. Judaism is very important to my mother, and I want her to be happy. I am a Jewish mother's son, if nothing else. We used to argue about the issue of Israel's dangerous external and internal alliances and American Judaism's blurring of its lines between being a religion about a moral community and a narrowly defined political advocacy club. The arguments got nowhere. Until one day, during a particularly ugly flare-up of Israeli violence, she called a truce by admitting that she knows herself to be too emotionally close to see the issue of Israel clearly. She explained that ending her unconditional support and love of Israel would feel like an amputation to her. The analogy is powerful and halting, and I learned from then on to bite my tongue. But my worry continued, because I knew what was at stake was not Israel's survival. It was Judaism's, the thing she really cared about. I knew that American Judaism was in deep trouble if it would complete its morphing into an expression of blind Israeli support while Israel itself behaved in some incredibly difficult ways to support. But this outcome seemed impossible to avert because it had also developed armor in the form of a rhetorical shield which accuses any critique from outside of itself as anti-Semitic and any form from inside of itself as the mere rantings of a self-hating Jew. If this armor could not be pierced and the mutation was total, this would represent the realization of the existential fears which Jews always were so sure would come in the form of an external enemy. But the familial truce was in place. So, over the next 2 decades of my life, after graduating college, I only whispered as Israel operated in lockstep with my concerns. It steadily charged towards becoming an ultra-nationalist and exclusive religious entity, and has now become such a thing, with the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, Benjamin Netanyahu, Naftali Bennett, and the likes at the helm of its government and military. In the last 5 years, it enshrined its status as a nation for Jews into its constitution. That's something my parents used to proudly point out it had never done as evidence of its open and equal society. It stripped its judicial branch of important checks on executive power. It continued to build settlements and arm and militarily protect the settlers in the West Bank under the severely strained logical guise of security. It strategically choked access to natural resources in the West Bank in an effort to influence Palestinians to vacate land which Jews desired. They did this while flaunting the United Nations and even the open disapproval of the United States. I knew the ready-made response to this would be that the United Nations was biased and anti-Semitic and should generally be ignored. I shuddered, but remained silent, when I would watch reports of aggressive Jewish youth mobs shouting death to Arabs through the streets of Jerusalem, who openly declare holy instructions from the Torah to not be homosexual and claim the real estate under their Arab neighbor's feet was promised by God to them. There were some media outlets interested in documenting the rapid rise of murders of Palestinians at the hands of religious Jews, and a few interested in covering the desecration of Christian graveyards by Jewish extremists. I knew that mentioning the rise of these hate crimes and pointing to alarming electoral polling data from the settlements, which showed them strongly supporting openly racist and Jewish supremacy political parties, would be met with dismissals that they were just a small minority without much real power. And that even if their interpretation of religious Judaism was not the same as the secular never-againism in which I was brought up, their behavior aligned with the survival of Israel, so we should dampen our criticism of these things. There was only one news item which caused me to fail to withhold outright laughter at just how complete the disfigurement of American Judaism had become. A planned settlement named after Donald J. Trump broke ground in the disputed Golan Heights. It's called Trump Heights. Really? This was just too much. Part 4, the prohibition against analysis. People have a very hard time understanding the difference between an explanation and a moral justification. It really shouldn't be that hard. Let me offer a few simple examples. If a used car salesman fails to mention the faulty motor in a car which he is about to sell, his actions are perfectly explained by the rational forces of a desire to make money. Is that explanation a moral justification for his slimy sale? Of course not. If a poor person steals a loaf of bread to feed his starving children, His actions are perfectly explained by his motivation to keep his family alive. Is that explanation a moral justification of the theft? Well, that's an interesting argument where you may have to have more context and history to the story to decide how you feel about it. If a man shoots another man who was threatening him with a knife, his actions might be explained as an act of self-defense. Is it a moral justification for him pulling the trigger? That certainly invites much more context and history before we could decide. There's a messy legacy of legal efforts to categorize different types of contexts and codify them into legal lines, which hopefully track the moral ones for cases such as that one. And if a group of men rapes, massacres, and kidnaps other men, women, and children from another group, can the action be explained? Well, sure it can be. This is where honest conversations about context, psychology, history, ideological commitments, racism, tribalism, and so on should all be in play, including, of course, religious doctrine. But could any of those explanations add up to a moral justification for the action? No, of course not. But declaring that it cannot be morally justified should do nothing to erase or diminish the explanations. For anyone who has ever tried to do this kind of thing regarding acts of terror, you're surely familiar with the rabid cries of anti-Semitism, moral equivalence, or relativism. So why would one not want to speak about explanations or allow explanations to be spoken about? I think the answer is incredibly important and desperately urgent. People often describe actions which completely defy moral justification as senseless. In other words, there is no explanation for them. There's no sense to find in the reasons for it occurring, which therefore rules out any possible moral justification from the start. Happily, those types of actions which defy all explanations are incredibly rare. In fact, they might not exist at all. Even an explanation such as the murderer went insane due to a disease and that's why he did what he did is a kind of explanation. There is another way which senseless might be understood in this context, though. One might say that an act was senseless because the action does not act in service of the stated goals of the actor. For example, if I say I want to not get sunburnt, but then I sit outside in 100-degree weather with my shirt off all day, you might say that this was senseless. In this usage of the word, you might be saying that the act of terrorism was senseless and that it will not further the goals of the terrorists themselves. I doubt that this is the usage which most people are assigning to describe acts of terrorism. One can also describe a morally unjustifiable event as an act of evil. This can merely be a rhetorical way to express outrage, but it can also be a way to appeal to the supernatural, i.e. senseless and unexplainable, forces as the only legitimate explanations. If an act is an act of evil, then it defies explanation and therefore moral justification. Racism and anti-Semitism have been elevated to this status in recent centuries as forces of evil. I recall a particular lesson in my Hebrew school where we were learning about the events which led up to the Holocaust. My teacher was describing Adolf Hitler as an evil monster. I was in the mood of taking never-againism seriously, and I raised my hand. I wanted to make the point that monsters don't actually exist. Adolf Hitler was a man. He was a man whose actions had explanations, and we should discuss them even while we all understand that, of course, the explanations would never amount to moral justifications. If we were really serious about our never-againism, then we should not be waiting to combat monsters. We should be on the lookout for humans with some describable combination of power, ideas, national context, charisma, zealotry, and so on. That's what would come walking down the street, not a flaming devil with glowing red eyes. The instructor was having none of it. Are you defending Hitler? My strained effort to respond with, of course not, his actions are morally indefensible. I'm merely trying to explain Hitler, got nowhere. The resistance to explain the morally indefensible runs very deep. Plato once said that man is the rational animal. Many psychologists have suggested that perhaps we are the rationalizing animal, but in either case, to explain another person's actions is to humanize them. To fail to engage in an effort to do this is to dehumanize not only them, but oneself. Once the process of dehumanization is total, then the stage of annihilation of the other is trivial. For when they cease to be explainable, they cease to be able to carry out morally defensible actions and thus no longer matter. This is why the long-standing prohibition against explaining Palestinian terrorism must be lifted. We should trust ourselves to be able to examine motivations for actions without fear that we are morally justifying them. This, of course, is also true about analyzing and explaining Jewish and Israeli fear and anger. But the case that I am making is that the emergence of never againism has served to provide the entire explanation for that fear and anger, and therefore morally justify all Israeli action and alliance forming. This is done while denying the same kind of explanation for something like the Palestinian telling of the Nakba as an explanation which would equally morally justify Palestinian action and desperation. Part 5, Never Again to Whom? I believe in the doctrine of never again to anyone, anywhere. I contend that this is a worthy rallying cry for humanity and should be studied and examined more closely than any holy book ever should. It ought to be the new organizing principle for a world where humans have amassed destructive power, which was once only reserved for the all-powerful gods. And it turns out that being born into Judaism does grant me a special role. I, and many other people like me, have been given a fascinating front row seat to the most profound materialization of this doctrine in a post-industrialized world. We have some unique insights to offer to help further this new form of secular devotion. We can share our experiences of confusion, frustration, and concern as we have watched American Judaism struggle to find an identity which retains the practices of religious worship while coalescing around a true story of political survival. Judaism, I would argue, has not done very well in this unique role as the custodian of this universal never-againism. It has stifled criticism of itself behind fully explainable nightmares of the always imminent return of deadly anti-Semitism, and it's forged a pseudo-global Israeli citizen personality where critique of Israel's actions are taken as direct personal threats to its very identity. But to cut Judaism some slack, the task was tremendously difficult. The world had never experienced anything like the Holocaust, nor had it seen an attempt by a newly formed international body to create a state like Israel in a place quite like the British Palestinian Mandate. This is all very new, and it was bound to be a challenge. But the clock is ticking on this opportunity for Judaism to be trusted with the universal never again doctrine. The never again to us crowd is winning the argument. The type of Judaism which takes religious commandments quite seriously is in command of the most important pockets of the Israeli government and Israeli and Palestinian geography. The alliance with the Christian fundamentalist conservative core of America may have immunized Israel to the fickle American voters' full support, but it has created some outrageously reputationally damaging bedfellows. At the time of this writing, Gaza is under total siege and being bombarded relentlessly. The West Bank is starting to see increased raids by the IDF, which has already resulted in several deaths. IDF soldiers have beaten the legs of mourning pallbearers as they attempted to move the coffin of a journalist who had been shot in the head. This was all done in the name of security and Israeli survival. Even the funeral beating, which the IDF claimed was to prevent an incitement to violence. It's yet to be seen what the outcome of the impending ground incursion into Gaza will be. The Israeli leadership shifts their stated intentions and endgame daily from the elimination of Hamas to the reduction of Hamas to rescuing the hostages. As a reminder, all of that behavior has explanations, which should be analyzed freely. Though, some of the actions are approaching the morally indefensible distinction as well, if they have not already blown past it. It's a useful practice to imagine certain actions which would rise to this level of morally indefensible, though still explainable, well before they happen. And if you find yourself in a position where no imaginable action by Israel could ever rise to that status, even when it's done in the grips of pain, anger, and fear, then you've fully lost whatever humanity and goodness that a religion should be imbuing in its followers. Israel, and thus Judaism, stands on the brink. It's in danger of being fully enraptured by factions which have confidently put the entire Jewish duality of never-againism and divine privilege into their pocket. And if that happens, then we will, unfortunately, be waiting for another group of surviving people to take the front row seats of universal never-againism as they attempt to learn from the experience of people who lost the struggle for what used to be called Judaism. Let's hope that it's not too late to speak up. Okay, that was the essay. Thank you for listening to it all. It's also in written form on whatjthinks.com. I know it's a lot. And so as I mentioned at the top, while I was writing it, you know, this doesn't always happen, but a conversation was unfolding live at the United Nations on this topic, on this issue, and the language used within it and what is, you know, still happening, it's happening very quickly, was just so precisely exactly what I was writing about and talking about. I mean, down to the specific words used in the essay that I just have to mention it and underline loudly and boldly my warning about all of this and just how dangerous this situation we're in is, and clearly, if you listen to the essay, how long I've been biting my tongue about this. But the UN Secretary General, that's Antonio Guterres, gave this statement at the Security Council. Just listen to it. He said, "I have condemned unequivocally the horrifying and unprecedented 7th October acts of terror by Hamas in Israel. Nothing can justify the deliberate killing, injuring, and kidnapping of civilians or the launching of rockets against civilian targets. All hostages must be treated humanely and released immediately and without conditions. I respectfully note the presence among us of members of their families." Excellencies, it is important to also recognize that the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation. They have seen their land steadily devoured by settlements and plagued by violence, their economy stifled, their people displaced, and their homes demolished. Their hopes for a political solution to their plight have been vanishing. But the grievances of the Palestinian people cannot justify the appalling attacks by Hamas. And those appalling attacks cannot justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. So that was the statement. I mean, if it couldn't be a more clear, yeah, twice just in those paragraphs says, and he says unequivocally, condemn the horrifying acts. And then he says nothing can justify it. And at the end, it cannot be justified, but mentions that it didn't happen in a vacuum and offers some of the context. So that's an explanation that cannot rise to, or an action that has an explanation that cannot rise or have a moral justification. As clear as day. So the Israeli Foreign Ministry, in response to this, demanded that Guterres resign and step down. And speaking, I think it was to BBC, Israeli spokesman Lior Hayat said that the UN chief's 1 minute in empty words about the atrocities by Hamas terrorists gave justification for terrorism, even though you heard three times said it could not be justified and he condemned it. Hyde went on to say, instead of standing with the victims, he blames the victims for an atrocity that we haven't seen the likes of since the Holocaust. So now we've had that one. And then he goes on and says, instead of standing with the message of saying never again, he's actually saying to the terrorist, you're allowed to do that. We accept your brutal terrorism because Israel is to blame. So, I mean, just listen to that just carefully. Black is white is black. I mean, that is as crazy as it gets, where someone can stand up and say, I condemn unequivocally this action, and somebody can respond with, you're saying that you accept it and that you're allowed to do it. And he invoked, of course, the Holocaust and never again, which is very much reflected in my essay. This is really, really crazy. This is really crazy. And I urge you to not stay silent about it. It's been too long. I've bitten my tongue, as I mentioned, for too long. And this is where we're at now. You have a right Everybody has a right to an explanation. This does not mean everything is morally permissible and morally justified, but there is an explanation. I mean, think about it. What do you want someone to get up and say this happened in a vacuum, that this was the first day on Earth, that there's no context to this, that there's just none at all? Of course there is. We all have a right to do that. And I would say it's the crucially important thing to do is have open analysis and explanations in order to understand them better and prevent them, because nobody is morally justifying it. Everybody agrees on that. So I won't have this. And it gets even worse. I mean, it gets even worse because just now, and obviously I'm just quite upset about all this, but you know, it is what it is. The UK PM, that's Rishi Sunak, says he rejects the comments made by Antonio Gutierrez. And he said his statement was, "We don't agree with the characterization put forward. We are clear that there can be no justification for Hamas's barbaric attack, which was driven by hatred and ideology." So there you go, condemning it three times and saying there's no justification, but somehow Sunak rejects it and says there's no justification. And I think this is probably the scariest one, because of you heard my story of my Judaism story. The Holocaust Memorial, this is Yad Vashem, which is a Holocaust museum, memorial center, also issued a statement. And this was the statement: in response to saying it did not happen in a vacuum while condemning it unequivocally three times, the actions, they responded and said, "The slaughter of Jews by Hamas on October 7th was genocidal in its intent and immeasurably brutal in its form. Part of why it differs from the Holocaust is because Jews have today a state and an army. We are not defenseless and at the mercy of others." And he goes on to say, "Those who seek to understand, look for a justifying context. Do not categorically condemn the perpetrators, and do not call for the unconditional and immediate release of the abducted. Fail the test. UN Secretary General Antonio Gutierrez failed the test." That's from Dani Dayan, chairman from Yad Vashem. So again, he said, "Those who seek to understand, look for a justifying context." Do you hear that language and how dangerous that is? And this is from the chairman of a Holocaust memorial. This is a museum. A museum's role is to seek explanations, to get context, to understand, not to morally justify, to understand. That is the role of a museum. And you have a museum chairman saying, "Those who seek to understand, look for justifying contexts." No, reject that. It is bullshit. You are free, able, and I would say intellectually obligated to seek to understand and understand as best you can. That was the point of my film with Sam and Majid about Islam, that we weren't going to be able to understand without a full picture that included religious doctrine, which was largely by the left, not being allowed to be included in the analysis. No, seek the explanation. Seek the explanation and trust yourself that you can still understand and keep in sight what is morally indefensible, even while it has an explanation. So that's all I got to say. Like I said, next time you hear Dilemma and see it pop up, I promise it won't be another essay about this, but I just had to sort of put this out in the world and put it on my own stream, because I don't think anyone else would publish it. So thank you for listening. Thanks.